Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and this is a special edition of the podcast. Special because it's not actually Tuesday, and also special because today is a special anniversary in baseball history. June 12th, 1970, Doc Ellis of the Pittsburgh Pirates throws a no-hitter against the San Diego Padres. And this was no ordinary no-hitter. Well, as ordinary as any no-hitter can be. This was, and is, believed to be the first and only no-hitter in Major League history pitched under the influence of LSD. Now that in itself is a hell of a story. A story that's become a cultural touchstone, almost mythic. You know, it's inspired Robin Williams' comedy riffs. It inspired a very popular animated short film a few years ago. It's a story that gets told and retold. If there's one thing you know about Doc Ellis, it's probably that story. But the truth is there was much, much more to Doc. He's actually one of the most fascinating characters in American sports history. Someone whose career and life cross-cut so many things that were happening in society. Race, drugs, celebrity, even fashion. So much more. Really intriguing character, which is why I'm so happy to have today's guest, Jeffrey Raddus. He's an Austin-based filmmaker who's created a wonderful new documentary film. The title is No-No, a Documentary. It premiered this year at Sundance. It covers everything that I've been talking about. And it also recently landed a distributor, so it should be hitting theaters this fall. I was lucky enough to see a festival cut. It's great. Well worth your time. So I really want to get into it. Jeffrey, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, well, Patrick, thank you for the wonderful introduction. And, you know, it's great to be on here talking with you because, you know, I believe we met, was that 2010 when you were working on the ESPN.com?
That's article? Right. That's right. You know, listeners should know that. You know, you and I know each other a bit. You know, it's a couple of years ago I was working on a piece for ESPN.com about Doc Ellis, about the LSD no-hitter. If anybody wants to read it, you can Google my name and Doc Ellis. Go to my personal website, patrickruby.net. And as I was reporting the piece, you know, you were working on the film. And you had been working on this film for a while, even before we met. And one of the things I quickly realized, and this part from our conversations, is that even if you take out this LSD game, you know, if Doc Ellis was pitching today, he wouldn't just have his own reality show. I think he might have his own ESPN channel. How would you describe sort of his charisma? And in terms of the social and cultural significance he had, what modern athletes would he compare to? For people that didn't live through the 70s, but need to be able to understand what Doc was all about and what he meant back then, who do you compare to?
You know, I don't know that there are any current equivalents to Doc, because he's such a creature of the social atmosphere in which he was immersed. You know, what we tried to do in the film was compare him to Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. You know, and Doc kind of perpetuated that. Let's say he called himself the Muhammad Ali of baseball, and some of the media picked up on that. But you know, from what I understand, they were friends, and Doc learned a lot of lessons from Ali on, mm-hmm. you know, speaking out, staying true to his own internal compass, and you know, the flamboyancy, getting some attention by being flamboyant. That was Doc's style. You know, a more modern equivalent in some ways would be Dennis Rodman, as far as, you know, the flamboyancy. You know, and I think Rodman is kind of misunderstood, maybe not to the extent that Doc is, but you know, certainly there's a lot more substance, I believe, to a Dennis Rodman than the media perpetuates. And right. That's Doc. You know, Doc had a lot of substance, and that came through in everyone that we talked to about Doc.
You know, it's interesting because I think now, in a way, like an athlete like Doc almost might have been more sort of accepted than then. You know, what the way he was maybe. You say, you know, he was definitely a product of his times, but also, you know, he was kind of in defiance of his times. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes, I would. I would. I would say that he was a very astute observer of society and what was going on around him. And he didn't feel shackled by biting his tongue or by withholding his opinion. And that contrasted him, I think, with some of the African-American ball players that came before him.
Oh, I think it definitely did. And I want to get into, in a minute, the whole racial aspect of the story, because I think it's incredibly important and very interesting and very illuminating as to, you know, where we were then and even somewhat where we are still now. But before that, since we did tease this, since it is the anniversary, we should talk about the no-hitter. Like I said, you know, it's a thing that most people, if they know Doc Ellis now, it's the first thing they know. And a lot of people say, no way. Didn't happen. There's no way you could throw a no-hitter on LSD. There's no way you can even get on the mound and throw, you know, 5-4-3-2, maybe one inning on LSD. People say, you know, Doc, he was BSing people, having fun with it, which he was known to do sometimes, by the way, as I'm sure you get into. After talking to friends, teammates, doing my reporting, I was convinced that it happened. I wrote as much. You spent much more time than I did digging into Doc Ellis. How about you? You convinced that it really happened? Do you think there's still mystery there?
I think that to people who choose to disbelieve, there's mystery there. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, my intention when I set out to tell this story as a piece of nonfiction was to get down as close to the facts as one can. And, you know, so I took all of the material that was at my disposal, including the interviews that I had with teammates, people that were at the game, friends of Doc's who, you know, partied with him at that time in his life. Mm-hmm. I looked back at the historical record into what he was telling Donald Hall, his biographer, in as early as, you know, 1974, some of this, he was talking about it. So I think that in my estimation, Doc did. He showed up at that game under the influence of LSD. Now, to what degree it impacted his performance, you know, that's more subject to debate. He talked about how he, when he got to the game, he went into his normal routine and he took a bunch of amphetamines and, you know, locked in. I think that from what I've heard, the people that tend to dispute the story the most are people who have never had any experience with LSD. Mm-hmm. Because it seems unfathomable. Whereas people who have had experience understand that it allows you to lock in mentally on certain things and muscle memory becomes, you know, incredibly important. And, you know, there are stories I think that nobody would dispute about musicians, you know, Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. and whatnot, who performed under the influence of LSD. So why not an athlete?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Actually, you know, Timothy Leary, the great guru of LSD. Yeah, at one point he, I think him and some of his, you know, followers, students, not sure what they were at the time, I think they all dropped acid and played a softball game. So I think it was, maybe it's possible. I have an editor, an older editor who will remain nameless, that told me in college, you know, he dropped some LSD and played, you know, touch football and was able to at least do that. So again, I don't think it's like inconceivable that just because you're on this drug that you couldn't necessarily perform.
I think, you know, part of the story that comes out when you really get into what Doc was talking about is he had been on this, you know, multi-day bender, and right. So he was on the tail end of, you know, an acid trip that had been sustained through multiple times where he had dropped acid. You know, so it's not like he dropped acid on his way into the stadium. This was at the very tail end of a long bender, so to speak. So, I mean, that also needs to, I think, be taken into account when you think about it.
No, for sure. Also, I think, you're right, because the story doesn't actually start, you know, in the locker room before the game. Here's Doc Ellis in the corner, you know, taking a tab and then going out to the mound. I mean, you're right. It doesn't even start in San Diego, right? It starts in LA. and it starts a couple of days before. To the extent that you were able to reconstruct, you know, the story behind the no-hitter, take us through that. What happened?
So actually, it does, in a manner of speaking, it starts in San Diego, because the way that Doc told it, the team flew into San Diego, you know, for a series, and because the team rules were such that if you were close enough to home and there was an off day, you could go home. And Doc's home being Los Angeles, San Diego is close enough, they let him go home. And the way he tells it, he dropped acid for the first time on his way from the airport to Los Angeles. And then he got there with a friend of his and his friend's girlfriend, and just, you know, partied the night through into the next day. He said when he woke up the next day, he took some more acid. And then the story that I was able to tease out, I talked to Les Banas, who was the photographer of the Pirates and a friend of Doc's, who was tasked with trying to find Doc because Doc didn't show up before the game in San Diego. And so he talked to a number of people, and I think he got the phone number from Willie Stargell. Called up the house, spoke to the girlfriend, and said, Doc's got a pitch today. Where is he? What's he doing? And that's when she woke up Doc and said, Doc, you know, you're supposed to pitch today. And she showed him the newspaper. And, you know, my favorite line in the film is Doc's line, what happened to yesterday?
Right. What happened to yesterday? I mean, that kind of tells you where he was at.
Yeah, exactly. That tells you exactly where he was at. And then somehow they got him onto an airplane, a short flight to San Diego. He got a cab to the ballpark and showed up. And from there, what he says is that, you know, there were, and I think this is an important part of the story, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it more, but there were fans who the players knew they could get amphetamines from, either Dexamil or Benzedrine. Mm-hmm. And so they would go up to these fans and get some amphetamines from them before a game if they didn't have any already. And so that's what Doc says he did. And so he, you know, to use his terminology, he locked and loaded and
that's right.
prepared for the game and went out there disoriented but completely focused on the catcher's mitt. And the way he tells it, the catcher put tape on his fingers. It was kind of I think it was a twilight doubleheader.
Right, and it was kind of reflective tape, right?
Yeah, it was the first game of a twilight doubleheader, and it was somewhat drizzly out. Second year of the San Diego Padres, and it was not a very well-attended game. Really,
no.
Really small crowd. Anyone that claims they were at their game is probably lying. I do have one exception.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting exception, actually. You want to tell people?
Yeah, well, so David Lander, the actor better known as Squiggy from
Laverne
and
Shirley,
mm-hmm. Yeah, says that he was there on his honeymoon. And, you know, he backs it up with enough information, and the guy was a diehard Pirates fan and baseball fan. He became a scout for the Seattle Mariners, I believe. I know he was scouting for a team for many, many years. And he was the person who Doc started to talk to in the early 80s about this episode. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of the linchpin with how the story made it out into the public eye, because he spoke to a Pittsburgh sports writer who's in my film, Bob Smizek. And from there, it was written about in the newspaper in Pittsburgh and became an award-winning article that perpetuated the myth from there. And this was around 1984, I think, where the story started to come out. But going back to the game.
Yeah, like so the catcher, you're saying, reflective tape. I still, you know, and we should note, you made a really good point, Padres, second-year team. They were not very good. This was not the 27 Yankees out there in terms of hitting prowess.
No. Yeah, one of the worst teams probably that year.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing I think that's really important to mention about the game is baseball in 1970 was not televised, but maybe 2 days a week, two games a week. You know, you had the game of the week on Saturdays, and then you had Monday Night Baseball. But I think a lot of people tried to look at this game, you know, from many, many years ago through the eyes of today's perspective on media and on the presence of baseball on television. And the game wasn't televised. The story that I got from the team photographer is that pretty much all of the press that were assigned to that game, the local San Diego sports writers, they all left the game after the first or second inning. So he was basically shooting photos to cover for them. And somewhere in the middle of the game, the general manager of the Pirates thought, well, you know, maybe we should get some footage of this. And so they sent Les up into the press box with a 16-millimeter camera. And to my knowledge, that's the only footage that exists of the game. And it's just little bits and pieces from a bad angle. It's not, you know, an HD full broadcast.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, that's interesting you mentioned the footage, because, you know, for years people have looked for footage of this game. They couldn't find it. And this sort of led to this idea. I mean, it was popular on the internet, but also even offline, that Major League Baseball was actually keeping this footage under lock and key because, oh my God, you know, this guy says he threw a no-hitter under LSD. Well, we can't, you know, what about the children? We can't ever let this be public. You know, we're going to have to bury this story. And look, I'm as conspiratorial as the next person. And also, I should note, Sports on Earth is half owned by Major League Baseball Advanced Media. So in case you have any conspiracy theories of your own out there, I'm just putting that out there. But I don't think it was the case that there was this secret vault with secret footage. I think you're right. This wasn't on TV. There wasn't a bunch of cameras there. And you know, it's almost we're lucky we have anything, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm with you. I don't believe that there's a conspiracy. I believe that what footage there is you know, has been shared. Maybe not widely, but you know, there's just not a lot of it.
Right.
And it's low quality. And, you know, even I went and tried to track down the radio broadcast, because certainly in that era, all mm-hmm. games were right. on the radio.
Right.
And I spoke to one of the gentlemen who was calling the game. I'm trying to remember. Duke Snyder was one of the ones who was calling
really?
The game in San Diego. I didn't speak to Duke Snyder, but okay. He did call the game, you know, and there are snippets. There are pieces of the radio broadcast that we were able to get a hold of. I believe that some of it is a recreation. The teams in that era, I mean, this really dates the story and dates that game. In that era, every year, teams would put out, or you know, the successful teams would put out a piece of vinyl. They would have a record album of, you know, the 1970 hits of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
That's amazing. That's like me. I remember when I was like maybe 3 years old, 4 years old, we had a vinyl album of the Star Wars, the movie. You could listen to the movie.
Yeah.
Like, even before
this is exactly in that vein. And so there's a little bit of material that comes through that angle, but I was told that some of that is a recreation. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob Prince called the game for the Pittsburgh Pirates, the famous announcer for many, many years of the Pirates. And, you know, so there are snippets here and there, but the challenge was assembling them all into something that resembled, you know, what happened. But there is no historical record of exactly what happened. It's people's memories and recollections, and a little snippet here, a little snippet there.
Well, speaking of those memories, so you talked to as many people as you can that were there, that played in the game, that former teammates, people that called the game on radio. At the time, in that game, you know, how did Doc actually pitch? You know, how did he manage a no-hitter? And also, did anybody that was there have any suspicion that something was up or something was off or different?
The way that Doc tells it is that he was always crazy for every game. And so, it was a for him, it was about managing the batters. If they thought he was crazy, they didn't know what was going to happen next. And so that was kind of a persona that he perpetuated. And mm-hmm. so what he says is his team knew he was high. They didn't know what he was high on. And but there were a couple of other interesting aspects to that game. You know, Dave Cash, second baseman for the Pirates, the way that he tells it, he went to Doc early in the game and said, "You got a no-no going," or, you know, "You got a no-hitter going." I'm not exactly sure how he phrased it, but the other teammates, you know, baseball players are superstitious lot. And so the other teammates kind of cooled down Dave and said, "Don't talk about it. You don't talk about these things while they're happening." Mm-hmm. And then Doc came back and said to Dave a few innings later, "Dave, I still got a no-no going." And I don't know if this is true. I was never able to track it down. You know, somebody could do some lexicographic research on this, but to my knowledge, that is the first use of the term no-no to refer to a no-hitter in baseball.
Really? So Doc Ellis and Dave Cash may have given us the term no-no.
That's the first known usage that I've been able to find, but I, you know, if it probably happened before then. For all I know, it goes back into the Negro Leagues and, you know, the 19th century. But that's the first documented instance that I was able to find, and, you know, the threads became really difficult to track after. Sure. So we can claim that until somebody disputes.
That's kind of cool. Didn't also speaking of the term no-no, didn't Doc have like a jacket that said no-no on the back afterwards?
Doc had the clubhouse guy stitch no-no on a jacket that his warm-up jacket, and he wore it for quite a while. Nobody knows what happened to it. I had a recreation of that made in December to wear around at film festivals, and you know it was a nice touch to the story, and we use that as kind of the primary still photo for the film.
Right, it's a great photo. I mean, it's really eye catching, and it does, you know, also though, it speaks to also some of Doc's flamboyance. But here's something that I thought was interesting about this game, the aftermath of it. So you mentioned earlier Doc published, while he was still playing in MLB, a biographical book with Donald Hall, the author Donald Hall, who, by the way, he went on to become the Poet Laureate of the United States, which is another really interesting, unique aspect of Doc's story. And I recommend that book to everybody. It's called Doc Ellis and the Country of Baseball. It's a terrific book. And obviously, with Donald Hall writing, it's terrifically written. I mean, it's unlike any other sports book you'll ever read. In that book, though, at least in the edition that came out at the time, the LSD stuff was edited out. And basically, Doc said stuff like, "I was drinking screwdrivers" or "drinking a bunch of alcohol." And like you noted, he didn't actually come public with the LSD part of the story until the 1980s. Why did he keep it secret? And then why did he go public?
So I'm glad that you bring up the Donald Hall biography, mm-hmm. because that's really what brought me into the story. The relationship between Donald Hall, who's this graybeard poet, and Doc, to me, is one of those fascinating, you know, points in his life, in his life story. And like you said, his biography is phenomenal. I believe it may be the only biography that Donald Hall wrote. And
it's so intimate compared to most sports books. It's so psychological. It's so empathetic. I mean, for whatever reasons, Donald Hall and Doc Ellis made like a real connection, I think.
Yeah,
like
no
a deep
question.
Connection.
Yeah, they were lifelong friends after that. And, you know, the way that Donald Hall told it, and we did interview him, is, you know, Doc found out that he was a poet, and Doc was an extremely inquisitive person. And mm-hmm. he's like, "Well, you're a poet? What does a poet do? Tell me, talk to me about what is a poet? Tell me about it." And that kind of started their friendship. And then Doc said, "I'm going to have a biography someday," kind of fishing to get Donald Hall to you know, get hooked on and to write it. And, you know, he fell for it. And for Donald Hall, it was an opportunity for him to kind of regain a little bit of youthful spirit, because I think that's something about baseball that came through to me in making this movie, is just the youthfulness that you feel, because it's a game. Donald Hall wrote a book of short story essays called Fathers Playing Catch with Sons, and I think that's kind of the essence of what baseball is. It's about playing catch with your dad and about being young, and I think that, you know, that was something that Donald Hall and Doc Ellis were able to share. And so,
although we should note, the book is like I said, it's a very intimate portrait. So it's not a, you know, just Field of Dreams type stuff. It's incredibly, you know, it sketches out, you know, how, where Doc came from, where he grew up in L.A., what that was like. It sketches out a lot of the racism at the time. It sketches out a lot of the injustice at the time. It sketches out pitching. You know, how Doc approached the mound, why he did what he did. It talks about the business of the game. I mean, it really gets into so many different things.
Absolutely. Again, it's a portrait of, you know, not only Doc, but of pitching and baseball. And
the
era,
really.
A lot of those themes, I think, ran through Doc's story. And I certainly tried to tap into them in doing, you know, the documentary film. And I think that you need to look at this book particularly in relation to Jim Boughton's Ball 4, which came out, you know, a few years. Doc's biography came out in 76, and I want to say Ball 4 came out in 70 or 71. And Boughton, his career was over, but he was pretty much shunned by the baseball establishment for writing that book and for revealing what happened behind the scenes. And so I think that, you know, certainly Doc's agent, Tom Rich, was sensitive to the fact that, you know, if all of the information that Doc shared with Donald Hall was published, that it would jeopardize his career. It would have put him out of baseball. He was in the prime of his career when it came out, or, you know, very close to the prime. And as Tom Rich points out, there were no long-term contracts in baseball. It was year to year back then. And, you know, I think if you don't have a question about it, I just want to plant this seed now. I think that the story, Doc's story, is as much about labor relations as it is about anything, you know. And his relationship with Tom Rich was extremely important.
Well, let's Doc get into that. We can come back to their stuff, but how is his story about labor relations?
Doc Ellis was the first baseball player, that anyone knew on certainly on the Pirates, who had an agent. Doc introduced all of his teammates, especially the African American teammates, to Tom Rich. And Doc and Tom met at some bar in Pittsburgh and became drinking buddies. And then, you know, the way that players negotiated their compensation back then was dramatically different. This was prior to the free agent era.
Yeah, we're talking about the reserve clause still. Kurt Flood's case hadn't happened, and then it hadn't paved the way for actual free agency in the Messerschmidt case.
Correct.
So players were essentially at the mercy of teams and of the league.
And so what Doc and Tom Rich came up with was that Tom would act on Doc's behalf and go in and negotiate, because the way that it worked back then, the way it was structured, is that the players went in and negotiated their own deals with the general manager, mano a mano, you know, in the general manager's office. They couldn't even have representatives.
Wow. And
it was on a year-to-year basis. Of course, the general manager and the ownership of the team was doing everything they could to keep costs down.
Sure.
The players would do everything they could to accentuate all the benefits that they brought. But, you know, clearly the players were at a distinct disadvantage in that type of arrangement, as you can imagine. And so when Tom Rich went in to negotiate on Doc's behalf, he was thrown out of the Pirates general manager's office. I think this would have been probably 70, 71 in that time frame. And they had to kind of work out an arrangement by which that Tom could act on Doc's behalf, or to at least represent him, be in the room. I think what they came up with is that they could be in the room at the same time. But that is a major leap forward, if you think about it, going from players.
And think about where we were. Yeah, it's a major leap forward, but I mean, it just seems almost unfathomable now. You know, we have like Scott Boras now, right? Players have guys like that.
Yeah.
To really fight for them. And back then, just to be in the same room was a accomplishment.
It was an entirely different era. And I think that Doc was out in front of all of his teammates as far as it, realizing that if he had a representative negotiating on his behalf, it was going to only benefit him and somebody to protect him, you know, because Doc, being as he was, his mouth would sometimes get him in trouble. So he also had somebody to kind of smooth over things in the press and to deal with flare-ups as they occurred and to negotiate his trade at the end of 1975. Doc introduced most of these, most of the player, certainly the African-American players on the Pirates and guys he grew up with to Tom Rich. And Tom was out there fighting not only to get better compensation for the players monetarily, but he was fighting to ensure that they would be housed with the rest of their teammates in Florida. I mean, Florida was still segregated as late as the early 1970s during spring training. And a lot of these African-American ball players, Manny Sanguin, as an example, they talk about how they were unable to rent houses for their wives in Florida during spring training. You know, so we've come quite a long ways.
Yeah, but it was a different era. And let's stay on race, because that was a huge part of not only what was happening in society, but also Doc's career, Doc's life, in ways big and small, in ways sort of symbolic and very practical and everyday. Like you said, something like not being able to rent a house for your family because you have spring training in Florida and Florida's segregated. One of the ones that I think kind of is an interesting case that sort of intersected, and you spent some time in the film talking about, at one point, Doc was ordered by Bowie Kuhn, who was a commissioner of baseball at the time, to not wear hair curlers during team practice. And actually, baseball tried to suspend him for 10 days, and it looked like Tom Rich was actually able to run interference there. What's the story behind the curler incident? Why was that such a big deal?
I believe that this was there are a couple of different angles on the story, but this was, you know, Doc saying, you know, I got to be me. I got to be free, and, you know, I'm going to do what I want. The way that he tells it in a more candid approach is that, you know, wearing curlers allowed his hair to hang a little bit lower, and it was easier to get some sweat and throw a spitball. You know, so there's
right. there's practical some value.
There's some practical value. There's some deviousness involved, but I think it stemmed from a piece that was in Jet magazine where Doc had his hair in braids, and you know, people must have really talked about that, and it got him going and thinking, and he decided he was going to wear curlers, and so he wore them in pregame warmups, and he had like a oversized baseball cap to fit over his afro with the curlers mm-hmm. in it, and you know, this to me, this really gets into the politicization of, you know, African American hair. And it, mm-hmm. I think that Doc was making a political statement. There's no doubt about that. I think that, you know,
you can draw a line from that back in the early 70s, again, where we are just, you know, we're just coming out of civil rights legislation. We're going into school desegregation. You know, we've got a lot of racial problems now in the country. We were a lot more backwards even then. But you can draw the line from freaking out over Doc Ellis' hair curlers to people freaking out over cornrows on NBA players 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's almost like the same thing. Just maybe people were even less ready to be accepting of anything that seemed racial or different. Staying on racism, what kind of racism did Doc experience in the minor leagues? Because you talk to some other guys in the film, and they talk about how it was not a pretty picture. especially playing in the South or playing in these small towns, being an African American ball player in the 60s and early 70s?
Yeah, these guys, when they came, you know, the majority of his contemporaries on the team came up in the mid 1960s, and especially in the South, the players were segregated, and the black ball players in some cases, you know, in the Carolinas and Georgia and the Deep South, had to stay in separate hotels from the white ball players. They were taunted from the stands, you know, with racial epithets, and I think it was a real challenge for somebody like Doc. The friends that he grew up with in Los Angeles talk about how much of a challenge it was, and how they had to make sure that Doc understood that if he challenged any fan to the point that it became a physical altercation, that would probably be the end of his career. So he had to really stifle himself, and I think that his humor helped, you know, and mm-hmm. he would use humor in a manner to diffuse the situation. And, you know, so I think that these guys were exposed to attitude, especially ball players like Doc from California, Gene Kleins. They hadn't been exposed to that because California was a little bit more advanced as far as race relations go, but they were being put into circumstances where they were the first black person that some people had seen, you know, in a position of equality with mm-hmm. the other white ball players on the team. And I think it was large and small, the types of things, you know, they couldn't eat if they were on a road trip in a bus, they couldn't eat with the other ball players, you know, they had to wait on the bus, and then the white teammates would come out and bring them a to-go container, but they couldn't go into the restaurants in a lot of cases. And Bob Robertson, notably, first baseman for the Pirates, and he came up at the same time as Doc, he notably decided that he was going to stay on the bus. You know, he was like, I'm show some solidarity with my black mm-hmm. teammates and stay on the bus. And, you know, the management didn't even know what to do with that. They didn't know what to do with a white ball player who was showing solidarity with mm-hmm. with his African American teammates. And I think that underlies the championship Pittsburgh Pirate teams of the early 1970s, was that there was, you know, I'm not going to say it was all roses, but I think that those teams were really racially advanced in the management of the team. You know, the ownership was fairly far advanced about how they accommodated players and encouraged racial harmony. And I think that, you know, somebody like Roberto Clemente, who by that time was, you know, well into the prime of his career, mm-hmm. he was a real spokesperson for unity and racial mm-hmm. harmony on the team. But it took, you know, over a decade for him to get there, because if you look at how Clemente was treated in 1960 versus how he was treated in 1970, it's dramatically different, right?
Well, yeah, speaking of that, you know, Doc in the film, there's one quote where he says, my entire career, I was an angry black man. And he wasn't quiet all the time about, you know, what he saw, what he experienced, what he perceived to be injustice. He wasn't always diffusing with humor. He was outspoken, especially for those times when it was risky to be outspoken. You catch a lot of backlash for being outspoken. Tell me about the 1971 All-Star game. You know, what Doc said there, what impact that had.
So in 1971, the American League, you had Vito Blue, who was just, he was off to this phenomenal start. I believe he had 17 wins before the All-Star game, which wow. is just, it's amazing. And he was just throwing heat. And so he was a lock for the American League All-Star pitcher. And in the National League, you know, you had a lot of really good pitchers that year. I think Steve Carlton, Tom Seaver, Doc had 14 wins going into the All-Star game, so he was certainly, you know, in the top of his form. And Doc, it's unclear exactly where this started, but Doc said to whatever media was around, they're not going to start a brother against a brother they, referring to Sparky Anderson, who was the manager of the National League squad and would make the choice of the starting pitcher, so Doc said they're not going to start a brother against a brother in the All-Star game. And this turned into kind of a media frenzy. And the press, you know, mainly the newspapers, picked up on it and ran with it and tried to stir up a controversy, because there's nothing like a controversy to sell newspapers or TV, as the case may be today.
And Doc got caught some backlash, right, for saying this?
I think he didn't get any, you know, career setbacks. He was chosen as the starting pitcher, so his reverse psychology ploy worked
right.
pretty well.
He was clever, too.
The I think he got a lot of backlash from fans.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
He was
fans.
Booed when he was announced, you know, booed when his name was announced in the All-Star game. He also tells a story about that game, how he got drunk at a reception before the game. You know, Doc, this was like at the height of his partying lifestyle. So I don't think he cared. As soon as he left the game, he went off with Willie Mays and Willie Stargell and, you know, left. He wasn't even in the stadium when the game ended. So he was fairly laissez-faire about that kind of stuff. And, you know, arguably it had a good impact on his career, because he ended up starting for the National League All-Star team. And, you know, it's certainly arguable whether or not Sparky Anderson would have chosen him, and, you know, whether or not Doc was correct in his assessment of Sparky Anderson. But, you know, look at the racial composition of the Cincinnati Reds in the early 1970s compared to the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Well, the Pirates were the first team to have an all African American and, you know, Latin starting lineup, right?
And that was also in 1971.
And that was Doc, right? Doc was on the mound.
September 1st of 1971, Doc was on the mound. It was against the Philadelphia Phillies, which I think is interesting, because is the team that Curt Flood refused to get traded to, because he said it is the most northern city in the South. And, you know, the Phillies were terrible about integrating racially, you know? So I think it's somewhat ironic that the Pirates achieved this event against the Phillies. Doc started, he got rocked pretty hard, and they were down by like 7 runs in the second inning, I believe. You'd have to look at the box score. I may not be exactly right on that, but 9 starting players were all black, mix of African American and Latinos. You had Roberto Clemente there and Manny Sanguin, but that was the first time. And I think that's somewhat mind-boggling to think, you know, what year did baseball get integrated with Jackie Robinson? It was in the 40s, right? 1940 something.
Yeah, I mean, it was far earlier.
Yeah, so we're talking over a 30-year gap to when finally the starting 9 were all black players. That's something. And I think that game, the guys that played in it didn't, you know, they talked about not realizing it at the time. And I think that some of them kind of realized it. Gene Kleins tells a really touching anecdote about how one of the ball boys referred to the team as the Homestead Grays, which was a Negro League team from Pittsburgh. Right. You know, so some people there on that day were aware of it, but I think in retrospect, it's only become more and more important. And I think something that I tried to tease out in the film, but maybe didn't get as much as I'd like, is that also represents the height of African-American participation in baseball. And that if you look at the curve, there's been a decline since the early 1970s, and it can be attributed to a lot of things, the rise of Latin America. But I think it can also be attributed to the fact that somebody like Doc and a lot, you know, dozens of people from his part of Los Angeles, they were all mentored by this former Negro League ace, Chet Brewer. And I think that form of mentorship has gone away. I think that the NBA and NFL have grown dramatically in their importance within that community. You know, so people that would have gone on and played baseball today, you know, that went on and played baseball would have gone on and done something else today, played basketball or football, because most of these guys were all around great athletes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Didn't Doc Ellis, didn't he potentially have a scholarship to play basketball at UCLA?
Not at UCLA. Maybe if he had gotten his grades together better. He went and played basketball in junior college. His preferred sport in high school at Gardena High School in Los Angeles was basketball. He was selected as All Marine League in basketball, I think 1 or 2 years that he played, and he didn't even play baseball in high school until his senior year. The way he tells it is they caught him drinking in the bathroom, and as punishment, he didn't like the manager of the baseball team in his high school. He thought the guy was racist, and so as punishment for getting caught drinking, he was forced to play on the baseball team. You figure that one out. I'm not sure that it was. He felt like it was punishment, but you know, so Doc played primarily hoops in high school. He went on to junior college at Harbor Junior College and played basketball there. I don't even think he played baseball. Baseball to him was something he was good at, but I don't think it was his true love as far as sports go. And I think that was probably true with a lot of the guys of that era, where, you know, but baseball was a decent path to, you know, at that time, a middle class lifestyle. Mm-hmm. A good paycheck, and then later on it became, you know, the salaries became much higher and more inflated, but you know, go ahead.
No, let's talk for a second. Yeah, because this is a sports podcast, and I generally talk about the bigger picture stuff, but I do like to get sports in there when I can, sports on earth and all that. Let's talk about Doc as a pitcher, because like you said, I mean, here's a guy who obviously was a good athlete, But also, you know, wasn't necessarily hyper focused on just baseball for a long time, but he became an all-star, threw a no-hitter. He obviously had some talent. What was he like on the mound? How would you describe him? What was his game like? What was his persona like? What made him effective?
I think that Doc's thing was he had good control of the ball. He could throw some junk, you know, sliders that would drop dramatically, you know, and he learned a lot of this coming up. He learned it from Chet Brewer and other people. But his primary tool was intimidation. He liked to establish some dominance for himself up on the mound. He wasn't afraid to throw at hitters. It was a different era in the sense that they let the pitcher get away with a little bit more as far as throwing inside, and Doc used that to his advantage. He was an extremely astute pitcher about the, you know, habits and what different batters like to hit. He kept a book on the hitters and he paid a lot of attention. He picked the brains of other pitchers on his team and other opposing pitchers. So he used all of these different things to his advantage. But I think that the primary thing was he tried to keep the batter guessing and intimidated or afraid. You know, he said, you know, looking at me on that mound, they didn't know what I was going to do out there. And that was kind of his attitude, was keep them guessing, keep them a little scared and throw good stuff. He wasn't an overpowering fastball pitcher, but he had a lot of different pitches in his repertoire and some of his pitches could really move.
You talk about Doc keeping hitters off balance. It seemed to me in my reporting on my story, and I'm sure you came across it as well, you know, for a guy who was super charismatic, who was very popular in the Pittsburgh community, who seemed to be pretty well liked by his teammates, there was always something of a distance, though, there. Like, things were always kept in a box. Like, the people knew Doc, but didn't really know all of him. And it seemed like he kept the people in his life off balance in some ways, the way he kept hitters off balance. And we were talking about friends, family, media, whoever it was. Did you get that sense as well?
Absolutely, Patrick. I think, to me, Doc is this extremely fractal individual where everyone that looked at him saw a different face, you know. And I'm not saying that he was two-faced. I'm saying, you know, that he was just extremely complex, and he managed the perceptions that other people had of him. Marsha Hoffman, the wife of his longtime friend Big Daddy, said that Doc had all these pockets, and he kept everyone in different pockets, which is a good analogy, you know. And mm-hmm. I've thought about it and done a little bit of, you know, armchair psychoanalysis of Doc. And I think that, to me, he was an extremely sensitive individual. Yeah. You see it later in his life where he got really emotional about stuff. And I think that when he was younger, he bottled that up and he put on kind of this defensive armor to protect himself and not let people get too close. And some people could get through. And he also was somewhat prickly as a test. Deliberately, he would test people to see whether he would allow them to get closer to him. And I think that towards the, you know, his latter years, he became much more aware, self-aware, and fully realized. And he was willing to, you know, let down some of those shields and be more visibly emotional and, you know, in public, in front of people. And but earlier on, it was a form of defensive mechanism. So he was kind of, you know, prickly, testing people out and keeping people at bay and letting them in through different windows. But that's just the way he was, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about sort of psychological defense mechanism, and we started the podcast talking about the LSD no-hitter, talking about drug use. People laugh about that. Oh, they marvel at that. The whole idea of tripping on acid and pitching a game. But yeah, we know Doc had some serious substance abuse issues over his career, maybe even more so after he retired. You know, one of his teammates has this great quote in the movie. It says, quote, "I missed a lot of Doc's best stories because a lot of his stories happened after midnight." You know, I think kind of hinting at that. Can you walk me through the progression of sort of his substance use and abuse, you know, how it started, you know, how it grew out of an affected baseball in his life, when he sort of hit rock bottom with that, and also maybe a little bit of how maybe that too was a way of shielding himself? Because that's the sense I got after writing my piece, is that there was a reason to it. But walk me through all of that.
I think so. I think that Doc, you know, he turned to substances as a, you know, a form of comfort and protection. And it was a kind of gradual decline, if you will, where what I was told is, you know, in his early years, his grade school, middle school years, up through high school, you know, he experimented with Red Devils, and, you know, they stole some wine and drank some wine, and you know, he got exposed to it, as most people are even today at that age. Mm-hmm. You know, and when he went off into the minor leagues in Batavia, New York, you know, his first professional baseball experience, he said the drinking age there was 18. He could drink, and so he started drinking. And I think probably true to this day, baseball players, probably all professional athletes, do a lot of drinking. And at some point in his minor league career, it's unclear exactly when, Doc said he got exposed to greenies, Dexamil, which were all over baseball back then. It's a combination of speed and a tranquilizer. And this is a drug that was targeted by the pharmaceutical company towards housewives to allow them to get a lot of housework done. I mean, if you look at the advertisements, and we have some in the film, it was, you know, like, you can get your housework done, but be kind of smooth. It's the original mother's little helper. And
right,
this is what the baseball players were taking. And, you know, some of the stories that you hear are that they had jars full of greenies in the clubhouse, maybe in the 60s. I never found anyone that actually admitted that they saw that. I think that's more of a folktale. Mm-hmm. But what is very clear in the people that I spoke with and in my research is that 90%+, Scipio Spink said 95% of the players of that era were taking greenies. They were all doing it. It was accepted. It was socialized as normal. Everyone did it. And you look back, I read Willie Mays' biography. Willie Mays took greenies. They all took greenies. And so Doc, at some point in the minor leagues, got exposed to it. And what he said was, took one. He had a good game. So next time he goes out there, he's going to take two. And so it was this progression. And it was normal. It was accepted within that social sphere. And this is a time when the press were much less antagonistic with the ball players. They mm-hmm. were the press were partying with the ball players. And there was an unspoken rule that what happened behind closed doors stayed behind closed doors. And so mm-hmm. it didn't really come out too much.
You didn't have TMZ Sports.
Yeah, you got glimpses of it in, you know, Jim Boughton's Ball 4 and other places like that, but largely this all went on behind the scenes. And so Doc just he progressed in taking speed, and then as a pitcher. And what he said was he got to the point where he couldn't pitch without it. He tried.
He called that pitching naked.
Yeah, he tried once. He was asked to I think it was either by Donald Hall or Tom Rich, somebody close to him that's like, Doc, you know, see if you can pitch without. And he went out there. It was a spring training game. And he tried, and he didn't feel it. He was off. He was just like, he was thinking too much. He wasn't being automatic about it. He wasn't relying on muscle memory and just getting into a groove. He was thinking about every little action, and it just felt off. And so he said that Manny Sanguin said, Doc, you need your medicine. And he went and took some greenies and got his groove back. And so he got to the point where he couldn't pitch without speed. And, you know, this is symptomatic of baseball in that era, and certainly, you know, calls into question what were owners and management doing and saying about this. And, you know, then Doc moved on to other drugs. And by the time he played for the Yankees in 1976, you know, he was basically trying anything, anywhere, you know, maybe not before a game, but maybe. And he said that all these guys on the team partied together. The Yankees, when he joined the Yankees, they knew about him and they invited him out to party with them. And he kind of played it reserved through spring training. And then after the first game of the season, he opened up and he found out that team all partied together. And that's partially what probably made them such a tight-knit group. And in 1977, they won the World Series. In 76, they went to the World Series. So it was, I think this rampant drug use was every year. And mm-hmm. I mean, everywhere in that era. And then, you know, you move on into the cocaine era, which kind of came after Doc's career. But, right. You know, he was done with his baseball career. He started in the minor leagues in 1964, came up to the Pirates in 1968. His last year in professional baseball was 1979. Some people would argue that had he stayed away from drugs and treated his body more like a temple, he would have had a longer career. You know, who's to say? Doc said that he wouldn't change a thing because it wouldn't make him the person he became. So he kind of hit rock bottom in the early 1980s. He was living in Dallas, out of baseball. I think that for me, it was really important to latch on to this concept of the end of a professional athlete's career as kind of a symbolic death, because I think it is. I think a lot of professional athletes, when they get into their late 30s, mid-30s, whenever their professional career is over, a lot of them are really ill-equipped to move on in life and do other things because that's all they've ever done. And so I think Doc was just confronted with this real crisis of identity. And you know, there was an incident of domestic violence with his wife, Austin.
His second wife, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a wonderful job of telling that story and opening up in a way that I don't think she had ever done before. And you know, it's graphic and somewhat harrowing. And you know,
Yeah,
she left him.
it seemed like Doc was off the rails at that point in terms of just
I think
this.
he was. I think he was. I think he thought he was. And so he had been exposed to some of this messaging about substance abuse. And around 1981, he decided that he needed to go into treatment himself. And he flew out to Los Angeles and called his sister up and said, "Meet me at the airport with a bottle of vodka. That's going to be my last drink." And she said, to her knowledge, that was his last drink. And he went to a substance abuse center in Arizona and spent, you know, like 6 or 8 weeks there. Stayed longer than his insurance paid for because he just didn't feel like he had it. And then he kind of found himself on new ground, and he really took to the whole counseling concept. And he got brought in, I want to say it was 1984, into the Pittsburgh drug trial situation, where, you know, the whole cocaine usage in baseball came to a head in Pittsburgh with these drug trials that brought in, you know, a clubhouse, so somebody that lingered around the clubhouse, and all these ball players got embroiled in the controversy. And Doc was there, working in the media and working behind the scenes, you know, to share what he had learned. And he felt like there was an important set of information that he needed to share. And he decided he was going to go back to school. And he ended up as a drug counselor towards the tail end of his life, and you know, a very successful one at that. Because, I'm sorry.
You talk to people he worked with and counseled, and that some of the most powerful moments in the film come from these people talking about what Doc did for them, how he connected with them, how he helped them.
Yeah,
Why
absolutely.
was he so good at that? What was he like? What did you get from those interviews?
Well, I think, you know, Doc's counseling career can be split into two pieces. There's the baseball side of it, where he worked with the New York Yankees and George Steinbrenner and some other teams. And then I think eventually he settled into working within the California Youth Authority and you know, with these diversion programs where criminals could be taken out of prison and put into, you know, this I guess low security kind of situation where it was more of a group living, and it included, you know, healthy vegetarian eating and all sorts of different stuff. And Doc became a part of a program and worked with a lot of kids. I think he really felt connected mainly to kids. And I believe that what made him so successful as a counselor was that he was just honest with them. He didn't read them textbook. He didn't speak to them, you know, in really, you know, theoretical terms. He just talked about himself, and he talked about how I think his substance abuse really affected his own life and places where he wished he had done things differently or where he had failed. And I think that the LSD no-hitter, the reason why he started talking about it is it was part of his coming clean about what he had done wrong in the past. And he felt really guilty about what he had done. And he didn't really look on it as, you know, this fabulous achievement. He couldn't remember it. So I think that, you know, to some degree, he kind of made up or embellished some of the stories about what actually happened during that game. Because from what I heard from Jordy, his wife at the end, you know, his long-term wife, when he died, she said that he couldn't remember the game, and it really ate away at him. And there's a great piece of the film where Ron Howard talks about how he found
Ron, the
out.
director, Ron Howard, by the
Yeah.
way, which is another, we won't spend too much time on this, but Doc also had this sort of Forrest Gump-like quality in his life where he was like shadow boxing Muhammad Ali in the Pirates locker room, and he hooks up with Ron Howard because he's in the movie Gung Ho. I don't know if people remember this movie at this point. But you know, it's really these things where you don't expect Doc Ellis to pop up, and then he does over and over again. But please go on with what Ron Howard was saying.
Yeah. So what Ron Howard said is that he found out about it when they were filming Gung Ho, and Doc talked about it with real regret. It wasn't, you know, an accomplishment. It was, you know, something that he wished he could have done differently. And his talking about the LSD was his way of kind of coming clean, his, you know, a form of his 12 steps, mm-hmm. I think, you know. And so to me, it makes sense that he would be talking about that then. But I think the reason why he was so successful with the kids that he counseled is just because he was so honest about it, and he talked about it in terms that they could relate to. And I think, you know, John Shandy talked about how, you know, here's this guy that you look at, you know, through rose-colored glasses, this professional athlete, and yet he was so relatable. He was just, you know, down to earth and really human. And I think that that carries through his whole life. He was always that way, but it was only when he turned away from, you know, alcohol and drugs that he became a little bit more honest with himself about who he was. And I think that you hit the nail really on the head when you say that Doc used the substances, drinking and whatever drugs he took, as a defensive mechanism.
They were a shield in a way. Yeah. They were, you know, he talks about that. There's this one, there's an interview where he says, you know, he was afraid. You know, I think, you know, in terms of baseball terms, he was afraid of failure, you know, and he also said he was afraid of success. And he
yeah,
said,
I think
you know,
really
if you're high, if you're drunk, you're not afraid. You know, for failure and success feel the same. It doesn't really matter the same sense. You're sort of insulated. It's not just a shield to the outside world. It's a shield from your own emotion. And which goes to what you were saying about Doc being this very sensitive person underneath sort of all this, you know, braggadocio and bluster and keeping everybody around him off balance. He was very astute. I think that's probably why he was such a good counselor, is that he could really read people. He really was sensitive. He could pick up on people, pick up on things.
Absolutely.
It's fine. I also had the sense, and we don't, I think the movie gets into this, and my story gets into this, so we don't have to belabor it too much, but, you know, when people watch a movie, if they read the story, I think another thing about Doc was that I think he was in some ways that same kind of fear. Yeah, I don't think he was afraid of per se success or failure when his personal relationships with people, but I think he was afraid of pain. I think he was afraid of being hurt by people. And there's a point in his life early on where he's close to his father. He sees his father die slowly of what disease did he have again?
I want to say that it was heart problems. I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah, but, 100%. You know, his father worked. His father had a shoe business, right?
Yeah, he had a dry cleaners, and he was a cobbler as well. Yeah.
Right, and I think that the people around Doc all say that affected him very deeply. You know, losing his father earlier in his life, and seeing his father again. His father didn't just sort of, you know, one day dropped dead. His father sort of slowly deteriorated over time. And so it was painful and it was protracted. You add that to some of these racial things he dealt with, you know, where all of a sudden, you know, Don Hall writes about it very eloquently, but, you know, he grew up in a family, in a neighborhood where that wasn't really a concern. And all of a sudden he goes out in the world and he's being told he's a second class human being because of his skin color. That hurt him. And I think, again, I got the sense at the end of the process and the end of your movie too, that, you know, his life was almost this arc of sort of building up these defenses and then sort of tearing them all down. And like you mm-hmm. said, to sort of be able to be honest with himself and be honest with other people. And there was something about that that I thought was so, so relatable for all of us in our own ways. I thought, you know, it's like Doc's story didn't just speak to this era. It didn't just speak to these bigger things going on in the culture, but it's this incredibly personal story that I think any of us could sit and in some way actually relate to. Did you get that sense? Like by the end of, when you're done working on this, did you feel like Doc wasn't just someone that, you know, fascinated you, but was someone you could really, really see some commonalities with?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was one of his real strengths, was that he could relate to people in different social strata, from mm-hmm. different backgrounds, in a way that is extremely rare. And it was a certainly a quality of his. I mean, speaking of death, you know, I may have taken a little bit of dramatic liberty, but maybe not. You know, Roberto Clemente, his death had a major impact on the entire Pirates organization.
It certainly did. Doc unquestionably, Ellis. Unquestionably.
And I think that, you know, his attitude about life and about drugs took a turn for the worse when he saw somebody, you know, one of his primary mentors and somebody mm-hmm. that he really deeply respected, you know, die in, you know, basically the prime of his life. And I think that Doc started to, you know, question, you know, what his life was about and maybe get into being a little bit more of about, you know, enjoying every day and mm-hmm. making the most of it in a perhaps abusive way towards himself, but definitely that had a huge impact on him. I think fear, he talked a lot about fear. That was mm-hmm. one of the primary pieces of his counseling platform, and especially with professional athletes, I think fear of failure is enormous. Because these guys are constantly looking behind them at a younger guy mm-hmm. that wants to take their position, or an older guy that wants to take their position. And, you know, I thought that his take on fear of success was extremely interesting. It's the fear of success, as Doc stated it, is once you're successful, you need to continue to be successful.
Right.
You know, the San Antonio Spurs, the Miami Heat, those guys, if they're not in the championship next year, everyone's let down. And so there is this fear that derives from that, of not being able to do what you used to be able to do, or not living up to the expectations you've set for the fans and the ownership and management. So I thought he had an extremely astute perspective on the question of fear, and he talked about it honestly.
I agree. I mean, not only do I agree, it's like that's like an essential thing to understand the psychology of pro athletes, especially. I've worked in this enough. I've covered enough to understand. I mean, we from the outside look at them. We see their sort of physical gifts. We see their sort of skill that they've built through hard work. We see their sort of prestige in society, size of their paychecks, all those kinds of things. And it's sort of, it's hard to imagine that these people, men and women, beneath all that, are actually mostly tremendously insecure, and in an incredibly insecure profession. And all the sort of benefits that are ladled on them can also become sources of pressure. And again, they can just amp up that fear of failure. I think that's, like I said, I mean, in my own experience, I see that across the board with athletes. And most of them, partially how they deal with it is to never talk about it. And they try not to even acknowledge it. But when you get to know them well enough, talk to them after their careers are, when they had time to reflect, maybe time to actually process it, it's a commonality for almost all of them. No matter what sport, no matter how good they were, maybe they were the bench warmer at the end of the bench, maybe there's a star player, is that same feeling. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that all of the rest of us can relate to that too, because we all have that in our own ways, in our own lives, with whatever it is we're trying to do, whatever it is the people we're trying to be close to. And so, like I said, I think that there's something in this film and in Doc's story that is interesting just on a human level. Even if you don't care about baseball, you don't care about LSD, you don't care about race, all these things we've talked about, there's still something there. And I would definitely recommend people see it. Jeffrey, we're almost out of time. I know you've spent, how many years on this now? Is it more than half a decade making this movie?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to go back to when I first started thinking about it, it's probably been a decade. You know, it's not every day's worth of work in that 10 sure. years, but I've been thinking about it for 10 years.
Have you ever thought about me writing a biography of Doc Ellis? Is there anything that you've gathered?
I have thought about it, Patrick. You want to collaborate on that?
You know what? We could talk my bosses into we could find the right size advance, talk my bosses into letting that happen. Maybe we could. Well, look, thank you for your time. I love to keep talking. Like I said, we've probably taken too much of already. Before we go, though, So how can people find out more about the movie, and how can they, when will they actually be able to see the movie?
So the best way to find information about the film would be online, either through our website, which is nonodoc.com, or through Facebook/documentary with a K, DOCK, umentary, or on Twitter at documentary. And that we're going to be putting out more information as we're allowed to share it over the coming months. But the goal is early autumn, bring the film to larger audiences. We've had a lot of fun taking it around to film festivals, but my goal has always been to share this with bigger audiences. And so just if pay attention, tune in, and there's going to be a lot more to share. And Patrick, I want to thank you, and I'm really honored to participate in this podcast.
No, it's been great. Like I said, I could talk about Doc Ellis all day. Everyone should go see the film. I'm looking forward to where it's in wider distribution. I hope it's in theaters. I hope you can see it digitally. I hope you can get a DVD or a Blu-ray, whatever it is that you need to do to be able to get it. Sure, that'll be a possibility going forward. And like I said, it's very good. It's up there with all the good doc sports documentaries I've seen and all the good documentaries I've seen. Well worth your time. Jeffrey Radis, thanks so much. In the meantime, and until next time, I'm Patrick Ruby for Sports on Earth, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.